Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Welcome to the podcast. Today's guest is Mick Smith, PhD. He is a digital marketer, executive, podcaster, voice actor, author, and a recovering academic. He lives in California and is the author of the book Burning America in the Best Interests of the Children. It's a fictional story in which the main character, Paul, a middle-class professor, has his world shattered when his child is taken by his wife, who leaves him a note. The story ponders the question, do the courts really act in the best interest of the children? In the book, the parents plan for their child's home, school, clothes, food, and happiness. But then Paul's five-year-old daughter is taken from him and he faces 3 years of hell. Mick, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here. Thanks.
You describe yourself as a recovering academic. That's an interesting description. Why do you describe yourself that way?
Yes, I get some questions about that. Well, I had been in education for most of my life and really higher education more than anything else, but I don't really do that anymore. I do a few things that are academic or scholarly in nature, but I really don't do it anymore. So I'm saying I'm a recovering academic. It's given me an insight into the whole world of academia, but since I'm not actually having a position in it anymore, that's why I'm saying I'm recovering. So I've got a little bit of distance from it, understand it. But it also means I'm a little bit more free to criticize and to also to comment as well, too, because, I don't have a job on the line that I'm not going to be canceled. So there you go.
And coming from an academic background, did you find that gave you any skills that helped you with your writing?
It's a good question, because that was something that obviously I had to cross that bridge when I came to it. So I had published a fair amount and maybe like 90 publications in academia. But then again, I had this idea for the story. And I go, well, you know, I've never written a novel before. And you know what? They're not exactly the same type of writing. So I know what a subject is, I know what a verb is, and I can articulate some ideas when it comes to academia. But then it's a whole new ball game, because you're trying to write to sort of entertain and get people involved and get them interested and keep them reading and to turn those pages, where most work in academia, you're doing it on a professional basis, either because someone says you have to read this or you're supposed to read it, or, you know, it's something that's related directly to what you do in academic work. So it's a different type of writing. It's a different style of writing. So I did what a lot of academics do. I looked everything up. So I wrote about and read about characters and character development and plot lines and all these kinds of things that as an academic, I just had no experience in. So it's a different type of experience.
And is the story based on your own personal history, or is it purely fiction?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it is real in the sense that I would say it's realistic, because yes, indeed, some of the things that happen that I write about in that novel are the things that actually happened. And here's how I put it together. I said, you know, the things that I would say, I'm a sort of a creative person, but I'm not that creative. So anything that you come across in the novel that sounds like, well, that's impossible and that would never happen, those are the true parts. I'm trying to write a story and I'm trying to develop characters and the plot and what have you and all the things that are related to trying to tell a good story. But all the things that sound like that's impossible, that would never happen. Yeah, that's the true part. So I definitely would say this is realistic.
I think it's so important for people who feel able to tell their story.
Yes.
At the moment, I'm being pressurized very heavily not to speak about my own story, even anonymously. Some people don't feel able to talk about their own story. Some people are frightened by others into not talking. And those are understandable reasons. But where people do feel able, I think it's so important because it raises awareness and helps bring about change. Because if people don't know about a problem, then they won't know, A, that there's a problem, or B, that it's so widespread. So it's really good that you have told your story. Were you a first-time author?
Well, it's the first book, I would say, per se, that I wrote would go back to my dissertation. That's the academic part of me. So when I was writing a dissertation, which is a book-length manuscript, I asked, for example, what's the shortest that I could write and still would qualify as a dissertation? Because the definition of a dissertation is a unique contribution to scholarship. And that's how it was. So I talked to my doctoral committee and they said, well, if you can write 250 pages, that's probably the shortest. I go, that's exactly my target then, because I wanted to get it done and I wanted to be as short as possible, but still follow the qualifications as a contribution to scholarship. So my dissertation is about 250 pages. And of course, it takes years to write this. You have to do language work and take the courses and what have you. But at least in terms of a project and in terms of writing, I knew the process. And so what I tried to do then with the novel was to approach it the same way. So overall, it took about 2.5 years to write the novel, but I took the same kind of procedure. I had a study. And I just basically put a graphic right in front of me. And I said, okay, here are the plot points. This is the climax. And it was a visual representation of the entire scope of the novel. So I knew it in my head. And the trick, of course, in writing is to try to get the ideas out of your head onto a piece of paper or into a text form. And so that was the challenge. But in terms then of also writing, I agree completely with your statement that everyone's got a book in them. They truly do, because they've got a story. So one of the things I try to encourage authors and writers is to find somebody that can help formulate. And that's really what I've been able to do, is I can help people to formulate their ideas and put it in a form that's acceptable. And then going back to actually why I'm free to speak about these issues, they really took place between 1998 and 2001. So it's water under the bridge. It's a long time ago, and I am completely free to talk about these things. Our daughter who was involved was very small. She was between the ages of 5 and 8, and she just turned 30. So, I mean, a lot of these things have freed me up from the ability to speak and to speak to the issue. And I agree with your statement that there's no way that anybody is going to change anything unless you're aware of the issue in the first place. And that was the attempt of the novel. I'm trying to get people's attention to say, look, these things are going on. These things are occurring. It's not right at all. In fact, it's wrong. It's evil and it's unjust, and something needs to be done. And the first way to get anything done, of course, is to bring attention to it. And that's what I was trying to do with the novel, trying to get people's attention. And then I moved towards other things, which is in the United States, we've got 50 states and work on legislation to change things in the different 50 states. And of course, then I have an Aftermath podcast, which is a co-host. And we talk about these issues and trying to help other people. Because one thing that's really clear, whenever you're going through something like this, everyone says almost the same thing. I know I did. I feel like I'm completely alone. There's no one in the universe who can relate to what I'm going through. And this whole situation is crazy. And I go, well, yes, number one, yes, it is completely crazy. It makes no sense whatsoever. But also bear in mind, you are not alone and people are out there that can help.
You mentioned your podcast. Can you tell us a bit about it?
The subtitle of the podcast is Custody, Parental Alienation, and Healing. And I would really emphasize that third part, because a lot of us got into these situations and didn't ask for it. But trying to get to the healing part is the key. And that's really what we're trying to address on the Aftermath podcast.
What you said about not feeling alone, et cetera. Somebody I mention a lot on the podcast is Ray Dalio. And he talks about how there's no new problems. And that if you have a problem, is to try and find how other people have dealt with it. It's very difficult when you're alone and in the trenches. You can feel isolated from friends and family, but it is important to find or to realize that truth of Ray's that you've just spoken of in a similar way. And I think it can help, definitely. I've seen other family court survivors write books and others talk about wanting to. There's that saying that everybody has a book in them. How did you find the writing process? And you mentioned it was cathartic. Was it also traumatic to relive those experiences? I found that when I've started writing. How did you find it?
Well, the whole process, I'd say, when people ask, like, why did you write? Well, first of all, I wrote for myself. There's no question about it, because I was so traumatized by these events and so disturbed and so thrown off kilter by it. I said, you know, I need to get this out. So I have all of this inside of me and a whole range of emotions. You know, there's anger and embarrassment and, you know, alone and loneliness and what have you. And I said, I just need to get it out in some way and express it, because it was a story that I felt needed to be told. So the first part of it was I just wanted to write and write for myself. So it's no question. It was completely catharsis. It just made me feel better to get the ideas out there. And then I started saying, well, what do I do with it now that I have this manuscript? And I think the odd thing about it is that I actually sat on this for quite a long time. And then lo and behold, some years later, about 20 years later, almost to the T, the same thing happened to my best friend. And I said, you know, this is just insane. How could this possibly happen? Nothing has improved in the last 20 years. And I said, that's what pushed me over the edge. And I said, you know, I need to get this story out, because if it happened to me, it happened to my best friend. And, you know, just talking to people and you find out this is far more common. At least in the States, there's something like a million people that are in the custody situation in the United States. And that's just an incredible amount of people. And it also means that if you've got one child or several children, this is really unfortunate for these children who are stuck in this system. So I said, yep, I got to get this out and I have to tell the story.
Wow. So you actually sat on the book for 20 years. That's amazing. So did you, I find it traumatic to write. I'm trying to write a book of my story now. Perhaps it's because I'm still going through my situation that I find it traumatic. Did you find it traumatic to relive things, or were you, was it in the past by the time you wrote? You know, how traumatic was it to write?
If any trauma, I think, and we all need to sort of face it head on. And I think this is what we find. So any sort of event in life, I mean, they call this in HR, they call this life experience, right? So, you know, people's passing or an illness or divorce, custody, anything of those sorts. Those are life events. And as human beings, these are things that need to be addressed right up front and take it on. And so I think the idea of when you experience some sort of trauma, look out for yourself. And the old saying is look out for number one. Absolutely. You need to make yourself very healthy and to survive. So I think a lot of people would say, I certainly did, is that people would ask, how are you? And, well, I'm okay. Well, no, not really, because I just experienced trauma. So I go back to the basics. And this is make sure you're getting your sleep that you need. Make sure that you're eating correctly. Make sure you're exercising. All the things that you really need to do as a human being, and also will help you to survive the trauma that you've experienced. So I think go back to the basics and all the things that, you know, your physician is going to be telling you all the time anyway. Now you definitely have to do it, because it will help you, and it will help you to survive, and then not only survive, but to thrive, because there is a day that's coming that this will be behind you. And the way to put it behind you is to make sure that you are healthy physically, mentally, spiritually, in all the ways that you can to thrive post-trauma.
Yeah, at the moment it's very difficult because it's still going on, but I understand what you're saying, that and it can help. I think writing can help, and also it's really hopeful that to see that, you know, you can come out the other side and recover. Really, I'm sure that would give hope to many.
You're the priority, yes. You have to keep yourself as number one. And, you know, I'm always reminded of when you're on the airplane, what does everyone tell you to do? That you always go, well, that's not my first inclination. But when the things come down out of the top of the airplane, it always says, put it on your child first, right? Because you're always thinking, well, no, I mean, you know, you've got to be able to survive. But no, you have to make sure that you're healthy first, and then you can help somebody else, which is your child or children. So look out for number one.
Yes, it's a great analogy. And I think it is true in lots of circumstances, although it can seem counterintuitive when we're fighting for our children in the trenches and we're being punished for it. But it is true. We have to be strong in order to help them. As I say, I'd love to write or finish my book. It's happening at the moment, but as it's traumatic, it's happening slowly. But I hope to get there, and seeing somebody such as yourself do this is so inspiring, and I'm sure it will be to others. Can you explain a bit about your writing process?
Yeah, when you're writing, of course, write and have notes the whole time, because you may not be able to talk publicly or say anything or actually have your ideas out there. But I think keeping track of things as they keep going, because it also is helpful as far as the healing process is concerned, because a lot of things are happening so fast and you're sort of discombobulated. But while you're going through an experience, also to write so that you're ready by the time you get things and you get clear from things. I think I had kept notes per se, because you certainly have to stay on track of things. And I think that's one of the things that really bothered me as I went through the experience. I found, I'm academically oriented, so I would read a lot. And I always thought, my brain was like mush because I couldn't read, I couldn't concentrate. So what I tried to do is just try to stay as sharp as possible for the situation that I was in. So I'd make a lot of notes and I would write a lot of things out. But then I think once things had resolved, then it was able to then concentrate. And then of course, I started getting back all the things that I had lost during the experience, because then I could concentrate more and I could think more clearly. And then I was healthier, I was in a better position, post-trauma. But I think you have to keep track of things, and you're finding out that the abilities that you have that you are taking for granted, you kind of lose. So you have to make sure that you are concentrating and applying yourself as much as possible. But I think once you get clear, then of course, all the things that you would take as normal experiences and the things that make you, you all come back to you.
Well, that's really good to hear, because I'm not the same person I was a few years ago. And I totally identify with what you're saying. Some of the capabilities that I had are just not there anymore. And I began to wonder if after a few years of this, whether they ever would come back and whether I'd ever be the person that I was. It's really good to hear you say that you can come out the other side and regain the capabilities you used to have.
Yeah. So once you can, I think probably trying to concentrate a bit more and concentrate on what you can do in your normal period will come back to you. But I always think, yes, you should definitely be trying to work on things while you're experiencing it. And it also just the healing process is, like I said, I think a lot of people feel strongly about getting a story out there. And when I had mentioned the same or similar situation happened to my best friend, he's a songwriter. So, he wrote a song about it. So, anything you can do, it's the sort of idea that these things will tear you up inside, and getting it out in some way, in some expressive way. So people will exercise, they'll do yoga, they'll meditate, they'll pray, whatever it might be that's within you, it's always to get it out there. So it's writing, singing, moving of some sort. And I think that's what is healthy for a person to do.
And I see your book is widely available in Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, etc. Is there an audiobook version, or are you planning to do one?
Well, I have a podcast of my own that I do. It's mostly for business, and I did try it a little bit, and I do and have worked as a voice talent. So I go, I should be doing my own, but I have not put an audio version yet, but I do think it's a good idea. So I have kind of a draft on my podcast, which is simply entitled The Doctor of Digital Podcast. So it is not available in audio version right now, but I think it's a good idea. And other than that, you can find it just about anywhere. Amazon is the easiest and the simplest, of course.
And can you tell us about your parenting podcast?
The podcast is The Aftermath. And the subtitle is Custody, Parental Alienation, and Healing. And you can find that on Apple Podcasts. I highly recommend it, because we have experts on, and anybody who's going through this could be helped by all the good people that we have on there. So we have a lot of people and good advice and good ideas there that we'd love to share with people.
And I saw recently on your Twitter feed that you did a post about AI and the law. Obviously, AI is all over the news at the moment. And I'm recording an episode on that topic of how AI might help the family court. And I think AI does give hope that, family law is one of the most archaic professions out there, I think. Maybe it's the most archaic. But if ever there was an industry out there that needed to be disrupted by technology, I would say that law is probably it. What's your ideas on how AI might improve things?
Yes, I've seen this because I was on a panel recently, and this was related to AI in education specifically. But I think kind of the upshot of it is that AI is going to be pretty awesome for a lot of the mundane and repetitive type of tasks. And applied to the legal profession, that'd be one thing, just simply recording. So, I mean, a lot of AI can pick up on just sounds and ideas. And I think that's one fruitful area. But I think it will probably replace all of the things that people don't like to do and can automatically come up with text. So ideas, questions, you know, if you're asking a podcast, you say, give me 10 good ideas for my podcast. And, you know, then AI will spit that back to you. What are sample questions? Whatever summary. So, I mean, I think every profession can start using it in such a way that would be helpful. It's sort of that thing or guide on the side that kind of provokes ideas. And I think one of the effective ways to use it, and more effective ways to use, is the prompt. So if you prompt it correctly, you will get better answers. And AI and the technology is moving so quickly and so rapidly. I think it's going to be picking up on all the things and the improvements that people want. It's just accelerated change so dramatically. And that's what I think what you see with AI is in technology in general. It just moves so quickly and so fast. And trying to stay up with it is to understand that we can guide it. That's the positive side, because I know there are people who are afraid of AI. I know there's warnings about it and what have you. But the thing is, we're using it. Always remain in control. And there are certain things that I think human beings are always going to be predominant. We have better ideas. We're more creative. And I think we can be guiding AI. So as any technology, I think we should be guiding it and using it in a responsible way. And technology by itself, it's agnostic. It's neither good nor bad. But it's really depends on the people and how you use it. Can it be used for evil? Well, of course. Can it be used for good? Of course. So it's up to us and society to try to apply it and guide it in such a way that it will be helpful. But I think it is going to replace a lot of the mundane tasks and things that people would describe as work, as opposed to the creative aspect of human beings, because we always have ideas that the thing or technology can't. You know, it's the old saying, you live with technology, you die with technology. So yeah, I think the same thing is true. And this is what has happened with this story of how technology has evolved all the time. So I'll give an example from back in the background of my family. My grandfather was a glass cutter. Well, there was a point where this is a very highly talented and artistic field. But then after a while, a machine can do it better. So, you know, yes, you can replace jobs and replace people, but then it's up to us as human beings to be creative and say, well, how can I benefit from it and look for the future and see how we can adjust it? Because technology just goes at such a quick pace, and it's gone quicker than it ever has been. So we can guide it. We can help it along.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to hear some of the things people say about AI, because it's very similar to how people spoke about the internet 30 years ago. You know, obviously industries come and go, but the internet's brought lots of new jobs that weren't around before then and people couldn't have even imagined. And I think the same will happen with AI. And whether we like it or not, we can't put the genie back, and AI is here to stay. For better or worse, it's here.
That's what I mean by saying that it's not going anywhere, right? I mean, you can't stop progress, as the saying usually goes, and technology goes so rapidly and so fast. So it's sort of like, you know, you can't be a Luddite about these things. I mean, technology is going to change as it always has, but then we also need to adapt to it. And so it's just that the pace is much faster than it used to be before. I think that's the difference, because every innovation has changed things. So the agricultural revolution and industrial revolution and information revolution. But since it's not going away, you need to accept that it's going to happen. But then I think it's up to us and people to apply it in specific situations and benefit from it. Because every time something is replaced and a job is outdated, Well, new jobs are created. So when we were talking about this panel, for example, there's such a thing as called an apology expert. I go, what the heck is that? Well, companies are now hiring people because they're now good at apologizing. You know, okay, you're disappointed with the service, and somebody then has to contact that customer and explain it. Well, that was a job that didn't exist. And so here we are in a situation that there are jobs that never existed before and now will be created with AI. And that's what I think people need to look for. Look to the future and see how you can best adjust to the changes that are inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, you only have to look at the jobs that the internet's brought forward. People in remote parts of the world can now become IT engineers. You've got children being multimillionaires on YouTube. There's all sorts of careers that just wouldn't have been possible until the internet brought human connection forward in a way that was not possible before. Now, I want to ask you about, do you think change, or your thoughts on whether change will come to family law? It's starting to happen in parts of the world. For example, I read in the last few days, Missouri in the USA may be on the verge of 50-50 shared care. Global change is going to be too late for you and I, but hopefully it will benefit millions of people in the end, and hopefully that it's not too far away. What are your thoughts on that?
Yep, I think there are some things that are happening in a positive way. So one of the experts that we interviewed on the Aftermath podcast is a part of the National Parents Organization. Now, they're based in the States, but we have sort of an uphill battle in ways that are more complicated in America because we do have 50 individual states. However, when they rank the states, there are some positive things that are happening. Ohio is working on some legislation. My co-host is from Ohio. So there are states that are working on this. And when we come back for a legislative session every year, these are ideas that are proposed. And what I would recommend people doing, at least in the states, is to stay atop on with organizations such as the National Parents Organization. But not only that, I agree with your point internationally, because again, because we start interviewing people internationally, we've had someone from Australia, we're going to have somebody from India. I think this is an international problem. And I think that's where we all as parents actually can guide each other and help one another, because it's a much larger issue than just one country, because I think it's a worldwide issue. And I think what we can do is to work locally. And so there's a phrase that says, you know, think globally, but act locally. I go, yeah, there's something to that, because we can help and assist one another globally. But then whatever your particular situation is, act on a local basis. And some other states, England, for example, has a unitary system as opposed to the United States with 50 individual states. If you can get something done in one country, in England, it has a large influence on the entire country. So there's an advantage there as opposed to some other countries where we have local jurisdictions and then competing jurisdictions. For example, in the United States, we have local, we have municipalities, county, states, and then the federal government. So there are several levels. And that's why in some ways the states are more difficult. That has to do with the way that we have evolved as a country. But I think always thinking locally. So this is always the hope. If people say, well, you can get overwhelmed with the issue, of course you can. But the thing is, you know people that I don't know. I know people that you don't know. So the point here is that work and what you can do around the people that you do know, and then collectively you can start getting change. Because if everybody's locally working, what does that mean? That somehow we're going to start seeing the results and the benefits and the fruits of the labor that we are all advocating for.
Yeah. I've got somebody from India coming on this podcast. They do seem to be, well, have some challenges there regarding family law. Somebody said to me that the worst countries in the world for family law are the ones that are linked to English common law in their histories. I don't know if that's the case, but it certainly fits Australia, America, and India. I would have hoped that these countries, if it is due to English common law, that they would have got rid of that by now. But it is strange that it's those countries that do have a common link in their history. But
well, there's something to that. I mean, you know, the name of your podcast, which I applaud you for just doing that because you are doing what you can do. The idea of fairness or justice is a part of wherever the English had an influence. So that means in the English speaking world, and that is India, that's Australia, it's Great Britain, it's the United States. I mean, those countries at least have this notion of fairness and proper procedures. I think the disadvantage of the other countries is the fact that they don't necessarily have that as part of their legal structure. So I think it's an advantage. And that means that I think that it's more possible to be a positive development in those countries as opposed to others where I think it's kind of arbitrary, you know. So, you know, there's corruption in other countries and, you know, who's paying somebody off and, you know, who knows somebody. And that's the way decisions are made. So I think it's an advantage to be in the somehow in the English speaking world or, you know, thank goodness for the English. I always say, because it's good that you guys got all over the world because it improved the status of people in many parts of the world.
Yeah. I think in many ways you're right. I'm in a state of not being very positive about the country that I come from at the moment. It's knocked me for six, unfortunately, my view of my country. But I think, you know, you're looking at it from probably a better place of perspective than I am. So I think you're probably right in what you're saying. It's hard for me to see it at the moment, but hopefully that's understandable.
Yeah, I think we're always affected by what impacts us personally. So as bleak as it might seem personally, I'm going to look at, you know, the glass as half full, because I do know that there are people working arduously on improving the status, especially for children and for people who are impacted negatively. So I think, you know, I'm going to look at it as glass half full. It's better than it could be, or it's better than just saying it. The situations are hopeless. They're not hopeless, because then a lot of people will show you that things have actually helped them in their lives and the lives have gotten better. So I'm going to look at the glasses half full. And, you know, that's the eternal optimist in me. It's kind of the idealistic side. I'm always going to say, well, you know, there's one way of looking at life. I mean, you know, if you are always going to look as the glass half full, then that's going to negatively impact you. But if you look at it optimistically, well, then it's probably going to help you as a person, and it's probably going to help those people around you. So glass is half full.
Yeah. No, you're right. I think, as I say, I think it's due to my recent experiences. But it's hopefully I'll get back on my feet and start to look a bit more positively in due course, hopefully. Thanks very much for coming on the podcast. You mentioned that your daughter she's 30 now, you said.
Yeah, it's turned 30. So, I mean, again, this is a lot of water under the bridge. And so for people that are saying, you know, is there ever an end to this? Yeah, because I think what you have to be aware of is that you're always a parent. So how this has impacted children or a child is always something to consider. So as they mature and they get over 18 and they're an adult, I would always recommend. And again, there are certain resources out there in podcasts who actually address the issue of adult children who have gone through a custody or parental alienation situation. So I always think they need to reach out as well too, because it's not what I would say normal. When my child was this small, I always would turn to her and I said, you know, I can't explain everything to her, but I would just look at her and I'd say, if one of these crazy things happened, what I was describing in the novel, I said, this is not normal. You know, understand that, right? And she would say, yeah. So I go, okay, well, you know, I've done my part. And then it is up to the individual as an adult to work it out and understand what actually happened to them, because it's not right and it's not good. But I think, like all of us, we mature and we have to understand in a mature and adult fashion what actually happened to you as a child. That is not like other. It's not an experience that others can necessarily share with you.
So, in your case, were you in contact with your daughter throughout her childhood, and then had normal contact once she was an adult, or were there periods where you didn't see her for a year or so during her childhood?
Well, it was, again, part of our situation was kind of unique to us. So everything was really a lot better once things were resolved. And I think the little bit of difference is the fact that I'm a little bit unusual, I would say, as a father and both as a husband, because when our child was very small, that is when she was a baby, I hadn't started a academic position that I was about to have. So I was alone with her when she was a baby. So this is what I always say, it's kind of unusual. I was the primary caregiver. So when she was very small as a baby, and then there was really no transition needed because this is something that was just second nature by this point. So I think by the time that she returned home full time, she was 8 years old. So I thought, well, you know, if I can take care of a 2 month old baby, I certainly can take care of a child who's eight, because there was a lot easier as the child gets older. So it was really simple transition. It really was nothing difficult about it. And it was really a very good experience from that point on.
One question is, where can people find out more about you? You mentioned that you've got your own podcast and your books and social media links. Where can people find those?
Obvious thing is on Amazon, Burning America and the Best Interests of the Children. But if you want to contact me directly, you can just reach out at the Doctor of Digital at proton.me. That's the Doctor of Digital at proton.me. And then I'm almost too easy to find almost anything. If you try to find Doctor of Digital, I'm going to pop up. So on video and other places, on Facebook and things like that, the Doctor of Digital is my nom de plume. So I'm pretty easy to find. So reach out directly if you want, or also find me online. I'm definitely there.
Okay. Well, what we'll do is we'll get some links together and put those in the show notes so people can find you from those as well. And one last thing, I see that you drive your parents' first car in sunny California, a 1957 Buick. That sounds really interesting. Can you tell us a bit about how you came to drive their car?
In the family, we call that the Bowie because it's a shortened for the Buick. But yes, my parents had gotten a 1957 Buick Special, and God rest his soul, my dad has passed on to his heavenly reward. And the idea was when he retired, he was going to have himself and my favorite uncle work on it and keep it going. So since he didn't get the chance to do that, I said, you know, well, I'm going to fulfill what he had wanted to do. So I still drive it. It's a great car. I call it an American muscle because, boy, these things are solid. They're just really, they're big and heavy, yeah. But it's American muscle. It's a great fun. It's a driving experience. And of course, in terms of the sentimental value, is just incalculable, because this was the Sunday car. This is what we took on vacations, and it was everywhere. So it was a big part of my childhood. It's where my sister and I would fight in the back seat. So, I mean, there's a lot of memories with it. And when my parents got their big dream to go out to California, we had grown up in New Jersey. That was actually the car that we went to California in and drove cross country. It was the first time I had been cross country, and that's 3,000 miles in a 1957 Buick Special in 1969. And that means no air conditioning, roll down the windows, because that's the only thing that's going to help. But yeah, that car has been a part of the family for a lot of years. So I'm really happy to have it, and it's a lot of fun to drive.
And speaking as somebody in England where petrol costs a fortune, or gas as it's called in America, what size engine has this Buick got?
It's got that big 350 V8, and that's why I'm saying it's American muscle. So I drove those cars like that until the 70s, until we had the gas crisis. But yeah, they were a lot of fun to drive. And don't tell my mom, but when I had also my 350 V8 that had my own car, I was running around maybe a little bit fast, but don't tell mom because she didn't know.
yeah, that's amazing. It's really good to I mean, what's that now, 66 years old, that car. Amazing. Okay, well, thanks very much for being on the podcast, Mick. Your story's inspiring because it happened 20 years ago. You lost your daughter at a very important age, between 5 and 8, but you obviously come out of it thriving, and you got your daughter back, and she's now 30, and you've got that relationship with her, and it's all, I mean, it's just an amazing story, and you're showing what the future can be for people who are going through these family courts and having their children taken from them. So thanks very much for giving that positive example to the listeners and to me as well.
I appreciate you having me, and I really applaud what you're doing. And keep remembering, you are not alone, and you not only just survive, but you can thrive. There is a day that's coming, and it's going to be a day that you're going to enjoy. So I appreciate your efforts, and thanks for having me on. I'm much obliged.
I really appreciate you coming on, and take care and best wishes.
All right. Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.